Really excited to have Thorpe and Patrick here. I've known both of them for nearly ever. Well, Thorpe for nearly ever. Patrick for half that long. Thorpe Fite is a painter, writer, and sometimes actor. His long series of paintings, The Ambiguities, began in 1975 and continues through the present. His novel, The Oracular Room, from which it was published last year by Station Hill of Barrytown. And I'm very excited to have Thorpe here. Thorpe?
Oh, great. Thank you. Is this where I read?
Yep.
Okay.
If it's good for you, tell me if the light's...
No, it'll be fine. What I'm going to be reading is, excuse me for staggering around here, I'm not drunk. I used to be drunk, but not anymore. those were the days. what I'm going to be reading from is this novel that was published last year called The Oracular Room. And I want actually to preface my reading with a word, with several words, of thanks to someone who was in the audience here, Christine Roan, who, as I say in the acknowledgments page here, had an enormous influence and effect on the production of this book. She proofread everything with me, and she made some editorial suggestions, which in virtually every case I think I adopted. I know I adopted. so thanks, Christine. This book is about two mediums, Egg Beater and Efficiency Cause, and that this takes place, by the way, in 1855, and they are not frauds. They are real mediums. Voices and spirits of the departed actually do speak through them. Particularly, two philosophers and scientists, the mathematician Gottfried Wilhelm Leibniz and his English contemporary, Sir Isaac Newton. And all this is perfectly true, by the way. And Newton and Leibniz hated each other. Leibniz might not have cared one way or the other about Newton, but Newton despised Leibniz. They had both invented calculus. And I believe Newton invented calculus just a little bit, about 5 or 6 years before Leibniz. But Leibniz published his invention, and Newton absolutely, again, this is all just straight history, Newton would, he not only didn't publish anything, he hated to let anyone know what he knew. He was not a nice man. And he went about trying to destroy Leibniz and his work. And the saga of this of the Newton Leibniz, what do I call it? The Leibniz Newton effect. The saga of that is tremendously worth reading, and much more interesting than this book, I've got to tell you. This is kind of a... Well, this is okay, but it's funnier than the saga of Leibniz and Newton. But it's really just a remarkable 17th century, 17th and early 18th century story. In this book, in my book, the two mediums, Eggbeater Cause and his wife, Efficiency Cause, the Eggbeater Cause levitates, and Efficiency Cause gets taller. She elongates. And their seances are wildly popular on the spiritualist circuit in 1855 in America. And there was, by the way, very much such a thing. Mediums traveled from town to town and gave exhibitions. And the causes were tremendously, this is, again, obviously fiction now in my book, were tremendously popular, and their seances featured remarkable physical phenomena, flying tables, chairs, all kinds of things, darkening the air. And this passage that I'm going to read is a little bit quieter, and it's Efficiency talking to herself. And this is still in 1855, May 28th, and she is there. I don't know if I mentioned they're both drunks. She's reminiscing in somewhat in the way that I used to and still do, but I reminisce sober now. And this is what I'm going to read. And she's talking about Eggbeater, her husband, way back when they were first starting on the spiritualist circuit and had first experienced mediumship, in her case getting taller, in his case levitating. And Efficiency says to herself, "Lord, what a lovely way with words Eggbeater had back then. The way he chose them, where he put them in the sentence, how he matched them up with each other. He just lit the words up, put a little shine on them, so to speak. The humor part was extra, really. Words just felt different when they came out of Eggbeater's mouth. And it was such a nice feeling. It made you want to laugh. Do you know what he said to me?" And she's speaking to herself. She's speaking to someone that she calls Dearie, who is herself. So, "Do you know what he said to me once, Dearie, when we were courting? He said that on shipboard, on his way to Aubrey, their hometown. After he kept hearing a voice in his head talking to him, urging him on. 'Courage, Eggbeater, courage,' it said. 'You are inseparable from me until death, for now and every hour of time. Come to me, Eggbeater, come immediately, immediately, quickly, quickly. Now, now.' He said it was a woman's voice. He said it was a woman's voice, Miss Barton. One he'd never heard before, until, that is, he met me. 'It was your voice, Miss Barton,' he told me. 'Yours, carrying all the way across the Atlantic.' And he laughed
and suddenly spoke falsetto, "Quickly, quickly, now, now." He laughed and laughed, and I laughed too. Efficiency sighs and takes another drink. "Well, dearie," she goes on to herself, "a lot has happened since then, hasn't it, love? And if egg beaters still saying plenty that's unusual, which he certainly is, and if he's still hearing voices in his head, which I'd be willing to bet on, he just as certainly hasn't said anything that I regard as funny for about 1,700 months of Sundays. And as for that old feeling he was speaking, when he was speaking just for you and you alone, my God, I might as well not even be there. Half the time he doesn't even look at me anymore, but somewhere behind me or off to the side, way into the distance or up in the sky. Or else he just covers his face with that goddamned antimacassar, talking all the while." Eggbeater does that. He has an antimacassar and he puts it over his face. Talking all the while. "I could go out of the room and come in again, go out of the room and come in again, go out of the room and come in again, or just go out and not come back at all, and it wouldn't change a thing. But I don't. That's just the problem, dearie. That's just the goddamn problem. He is a persuasive bastard. I don't know how he gets away with it. But if he wants you to pay attention to him, if for any reason at all, it's important to him that you stop whatever you're doing, stay right where you are and listen to him, then by God, you stop, you stand there and listen. I, the one now speaking, you, the one now listening." That's a favorite saying of his, the swine. "It's infuriating. It's insulting, for Christ's sake. And what's even worse, if he ever happens to get tired of if he ever happens to get tired of talking, but still wants you to pay attention, or if he begins to suspect somewhere in that gin-soaked mind of his that your mind might be wandering from the main point, now, that is, all he has, the wandering from him, that is, all he has to do is rise, goddamn him. Now, why the hell can't I do that? I try and try, and all I get is taller. 5 years I've been at it, ever since our very first seance, when he floated up to the ceiling, as if he didn't weigh any more than one of those little feathers he always has with him to stir his gin with. And left everybody's mouths hanging open, including mine. How does he manage it, anyway? I've asked him I don't know how many times, but he always tells me he doesn't know. Says it just happens, completely beyond his control. I don't believe it. Not for a minute. He's only saying that to annoy me. Well, damn it all, I'm his wife! A wife has a right to know these things. Shit and shallots. I bet it's something he picked up in Europe. Probably Paris in some goddamn cat house. Some little trick he learned to do with a muscle. Or maybe a twist of his pelvis. Something like that to get him started. Although what keeps him up there all the time, I'll be damned if I can figure out. Whatever it isn't natural, that's for certain. Why can't he stay on the ground like everybody else? He'll do himself an injury one day. He'll probably die or go blind or crazy and have to be put away somewhere. And I'll be left to carry on all alone. Inconsiderate bastard. Who the hell does he think he is? It's just a cheap bid for attention. And all because he's not funny anymore, and he knows it. Well, let him see if I come to visit him in the asylum. Just let him see that. What the hell? Thank you.
Wow. Kids will be sad they missed that. They love a good swear.
They're at that age.
Oh, yeah. Thank you, Thorpe. It was great.
You're welcome.
Poet and novelist Patrick Dowd will give a reading of both new and old work. Born in 1968 in Syracuse, New York, he grew up in the Bernhards Bay, a hamlet on the northern shore of Oneida Lake, and in East Amherst, a suburb of Buffalo. After several years of academic wandering, he found his way to Bard College in the Hudson Valley, where he studied literature and through friends and teachers was introduced to Thorpe Fite's incredible serial paintings. Books of poetry published so far are Girding the Ghost, The Man in Green, and Hickory Bartolino Poems. Books of fiction published so far are two American fantasies, The Hunt for the Eye of Ogun and The Mormonth War. Patrick?
Contortionist situation, isn't it, Thorpe? I'm impressed. Well, thanks, everyone, for coming very much. Dream of bad luck. Bad luck, he is in the house instead of flying peak to peak, the imagined mountains. And bad luck, too, so little to shoot him with. That manlike face and lion's mane, pressing through, metal bars too wide to keep him out. Perhaps to stand at a certain angle, in a certain spot, wishing him not? Position and will keep him out. This is after a set of drawings by Gabriel Barzagli called Forbidden Games, and the poem is called In the Woods. The drawings can be seen on the internet if you Google Gabriel and look up that title on her very nice website. It's not the same as seeing them in person, of course, but you can get a sense of these great drawings. In the woods. Prevented by branches and briar, streams and pools. In here, I am a part of and apart from the other animals in the woods. Here is desire, and I am caught up. But imagine walking paths of music and color, forgotten names for the rediscovering. Words of animals given their playthings, clearing space in their great loss. A shadow by a fox edging the glade, the caster passing near me preoccupied, sun and fox formed absence of sun. Round the bend of summer, three parts of three meeting temporarily, acting as one. In that fact-fucked shack in the woods of a far memory, two buckets of syrup badly sealed. To keep the syrup within is a burden. Win or lose, continuing to move in the heat. Not winning, not losing. Every chosen act goes on ahead, and circles back to catch me from behind. What the wind did to the sheaves I had not brought in. But I was a child, I cry, no more than a season torn. No more leaves to hide me, a bad winter it will be. Opposite the sky's reflection in the pool's reflection in the sky. Muddied and broken lines of a drawing, lines of a poem, before fluid no more, muddied and broken by wading in. Those who go in the woods to be animals among the other animals, those who are concerned with spring, there are some who mean to snatch them up, fuck them up, take them to their king. Hick Bard, this proud doubt falls flat and floats not. You should not, must not play in the cold, cold water. Now you have come to the middle. Now you are gray. Fall is submerged in the visual part of progress through the tail, crowns the oral way over the hills, imbues and covers. The demiurge within the fire, burning not of earth, not of air, aware with other than animal passion, a different spiritual strength, a stranger because of the difference between the place of his power and ours. But he watches me as I walk the woods without seeing the everyday gods everywhere, helps or prevents my being with them, being them. Help and harm a confused dream, stepping bare into the pool, flowing naked away, harvested by the stream. How far? In the sky's near place, between the house we live in and the fine old church across the street, no metaphor, no wish, no star that shoots, but a meteor, call it, or space debris, thrown God knows how far to become light at 2 o'clock in the morning of our anniversary, and make me a witness who comes back in, tells you what little can be told of what I saw. This is an old poem that I doubt will ever, in any of our lifetimes, be dated, unfortunately. Fragments watching war. Bombs of summer 1968. Bombs of summer 2044. Always more responsibility to live, greater force in death's pull. Life is born in the blood, and how can I be right, continuing to live, but never bear the sight? Don't care to lie down at night, rise in the morning either, but cares are ether, interpenetrant, and suffering unmakes suffering not. And a bomb forces flesh and bone of others into your own. A soldier bending, retching over ruined flesh on pavement showered. Another comes, tenderly rests a hand on the first one's shoulder. Stars. Days and stars, the fire's release makes free. Far hours and portals, fragments watching war on screens. As winged dreams of death plunge into the harbor, dimples in the rock fill with cold reflecting water, followed by birds. Yellow bulb, gray day, the heated room, brown puddles the cat puked upon the floor. Far and cold the killing, here and warm what for? These next are a sequence that's derivative of the poetry of Dear Friend. Dreams and Flowers for Ken Irby. Pillows of guilt, stack after stack to the cupboard top, and some requiring promises of others, like not to tell the students this winter there will be no heat in those rooms, beyond use, or to surprise that they were going around together at all, he leaving such a wife and sons, the place limitless, attainable horizon for him, and having already attained all that, and she living from check to check until they met, her sons grown beyond living for. That the flow is not always so, creases in the days, only we may close and open, the strength required of us, not wanting, still wanting. Dreams and visitations, secret ways under and through cupboards, trunks of trees, when it is the grief you came caring about, your poems on the unmade bed, the messenger at the edge of sight, hanging by a thread from the hair to have the ear. The house front thrown in, out by the many hands of the occasions, except the inner and outer doors still stand, and are blown open by the wind. So the dogs of the locks show their desire to go in by the old way too, to the sound of the old music, and with all grief they do. Pinex water for cloth and plastic flowers, tissue paper still scented slightly of the dress and the box, out of the shop of everyone's lives, out of Africa. Clues that attend the mystery as the gods attend us, not invisibly, alert to what is present to our senses at any moment. But never to have asked, do you have a window? And what do you see? The unfinished piece, the never completed final movement that is the house of the mystery, and the fields and the woods. What music could you hear? Delius's The Walk to the Paradise Garden, Like a New Season, or Fenzi's Romance, or out of the channel of old movies, the knocking of Orpheus at the gates of hell for Eurydice. To be with her now, after years and years, receiving a message that upends the end, even the moment where you did not think to find yourself. Forgetting for a moment that you are dead, I looked for a pen to write you a letter, describing the day's gathering, and especially that Garrett dedicated his reading to you, the grasslands of North America, the Wizard of Oz and the Blizzard of Oz, and the bereft. The heart without recourse, bared but for the sea of grass, winds blowing music there, the distance yet to the garden is known, and perhaps far, as the makers of that music. Later, the skunk in the evening weeds becomes the skunk in the crucible of the sunny midnight lawn. So we bathe the red dog in red juice. Reclining adrift on the current of shallow waters that beneath a certain depth appear white. Thoughts of the cave and other locations on the map you have not been to are hope, for the imagination's drift, but the waters take the body another way, too fast, nearly faster than hope is allowed to stand. Certainly the other not entirely, or the waters, or the depths above, however you may want to have it, what still makes lush the prairies beyond the marsh of swans. Back of the rocky coast above the turret from the war, there is a door in the rocks into the apartment, control. How pleasing the rooms, light even without much sun entering at all, and just being permitted to wander through, exploring all the way back to where the door opens to the city. But some stay inside to watch as two in the mulberry-colored caftans of twinship get up the dance, the one emerging from an energy egg of fame and word, his other fretting over the setup, the record. Frito corn chips and melted brie, myth and romance undiminished since the academies of last night and the millennia before. Neither are diminished the hierarchies of praise and gratitude where me comes to you. Still to be refilled, the jars of hibiscus, poppy seed, powdered psyllium husk completely empty again, and the juniper berries nearly also gone. But though I had been summoned to do so, instead I was watching from the edge, when he with the face of pointless criticism and sheer dislike, of focus intolerant, produced from his worn green army coat the fox he had rescued and befriended years before, her fur too thin and soft through the wildness, lost. And if I should hunt for the flower all night without success, that is not yet the terror of the flower's test, but a step. The paradise garden a joint, joining earthly and heavenly. Are you still on the walk there? And if someone walks with you, who? The work and the life and the death are for flowers, for poems, whether through the life alone or with companions, insisting on dreams and their relation to every other of connection in our lives. You have given me the gem for this day, in which all days reshine and reshadow. I catch up with you in lands where grief and guilt are flowers, among all the flowers. The sun warms and lights impartially. This is called Gorilla, and it's from reading a book by the philosopher Robert Lurs called, it's called Mind Reading Animals, and his area is the question of the how conscious are other species. Gorilla. In a sharp corner of the plexiglass enclosure, the young gorilla turned his face away from the other gorilla, the rest of the cage. Were it not for the cage, because of the cage, close enough to touch. Instead, the pain I read in his eyes, his mind. Theft to a young boy. Theft. Charlie, because you got caught stealing a poem, claiming you wrote one you didn't, and because lately you take an interest in the myths of the Greeks, I wish I could mention how Hermes got to be god of poets and thieves, how from certain perspectives the two are not clearly different, but it's too soon for you to know what I mean, and that is a way you must not steal. I cannot even say to myself, you will understand soon enough. And finally, this is an unfinished. It's a poem. It's called Branches. It's called Branches, and this is just a part of it. Branches, fallen from a tree, fought what broke them eventually, and now feed others as they grow, not toward breaking, though break they will. The tree strikes a long, defiant pose, yearning so terribly to grow, without a sound of its own, up from underground. Wizard of sizzling erudition and will, master of complex but relaxed aesthetic realms, the oak behind your house endures another budding of the year. The yellow cabin beneath its branches meets the dawn still. But what sense in senseless counting, while eternity swallows every instant whole, allows every instant an immortal roll? To either side, hidden doors, sounds expressive of their existence, grumbling or squeaking of hinges, or various others not dissimilar, the plangencies you drank to in the years before I was born. The music I still hear, its frantic strains, stresses, the subsequent packs that recurs, enduring oscillations of the real, life and death, states of self. Wandered your lawn and garden, read stories in your peonies, warred with bad wisteria and poison ivy. New singular peace under crimson dome of Japanese maple branches, followed golden toad to a hole among the flowers, puer eternis. Brooded on the burgundy jacket of the handsome long-haired page I met in the foyer of the Death Institute, coveted the page's clothes, envied his place in the system, occupied as he was half with research, half with tourism. Immoral not to feed the body, you said, and unfed the lack of moral sense drives the body to misdeeds, poesy of despite I have seen. Gently violent strokes of ink, coiling serpents in the drink, I have been afraid the poem cannot come until the body dies. There is a boat sailing for the realm of fairy, loaded with all of the commercial products that pertain to fairy this world has ever produced. Also on board are loyal agents of fairy, stowaways poised to do whatever is required, for this ship must be stopped. Over Ipswich, Essex, Annisquam, waters which seem still but are not, seeming still the horse and farm, still the man motioning his passing as he notes the horse, takes in the farm, all time crossed by one time. When before dawn the genius of fall stepped forth to blare of rusty horns blown by autumn breath, 100 crows conveyed what they know only to each other. Fox occult among the long hairs of the lion's mane, make the count of cancelled passages, other than human haunts of western avenues. Made of metals, the kinetic depiction of a spectating crowd applauds in the breeze, the quest for integration. If dreams are vivid, you could be recognizing the impossible, you also said. I dreamed that I dreamed poetry is to hide the truth in, a surface hardly penetrable yet fragile, immortal and no easy art. This is my wish for the body. Thanks a lot, everybody.